Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. I'm David Plotz. Joining me today, as always, are Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
And John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
Amy Coney Barrett is going to finish her testimony before the Judiciary Committee today, the Senate Judiciary Committee today, Thursday, when we're taping. She will be approved then on a party line vote in that committee that will go on to the full Senate, where she will be approved on a party line vote to be a Supreme Court justice, barring some remarkable turn of events. She brought an empty notebook to her hearings and testified very fluently and clearly, but an empty notebook and, in a way, an empty vessel. She has said very, very little. She's done an excellent job, as we're going to discuss, ducking anything substantive, as Supreme Court justices have learned to do, nominees have learned to do in recent years. She's tried to emphasize, oh, my personal views are not my views as a judge. But as sham hearings go, this is the shammiest. There's no pretense from Republicans that they're trying to do anything but get her through, and get her through rapidly. Democrats, by contrast, do not believe this is a legitimate process. So, John, what would you say are the main themes of these hearings so far? Not necessarily what's going on in the hearings, but also the discussion around the hearings. What are the themes that have struck you?
You called it a sham hearing. It's hard to know where to grab a hold of this. I mean, hearings have become a sham and not a, an inquiry into the judicial views. Well, I don't know where we want to start that process, but they're so much more now for the exercise of the senators, both personal vanity and then also just political theater, perfectly encapsulated by the way they begin, which is with rounds and rounds and rounds of opening statements where the nominee just has to sit there and be pelted by these opening statements. So, you know,
actually, John, sorry, you saying that just made me think. It's bizarre that a full third of her hearing is these opening statements. Where did that come from? It's an obscene, stupid, pointless tradition.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, it is the apotheosis, if apotheosis is the word I want, of a trend that has gotten further and further and further away from inquiry, an inquiry into their ideas for the purposes of advising consent, coupled with a tradition that has, in which Justice Ginsburg played an important role, of the nominee being either smart enough or cagey enough to not give a full open explication of their thinking, the provisional nature of it, the fixed nature of it, or the nature of it in any particular way, because that was seen to have torpedoed Robert Bork, who was torpedoed for other reasons, but he helped torpedo himself by talking too much, among other things. So the theater has so far away from what it's supposed to be, and we have the case here now where the votes are the votes, and our most recent history with Supreme Court picks, particularly Supreme Court picks in an election year, are that the substance doesn't matter, that power does. The substantive issues are the Affordable Care Act, abortion, the extent to which Judge Barrett is going to be captive of the Trump administration. I was thinking about Bush v. Gore, and how that reflects on the president's claim that there need to be 9 justices in order to have a full court to adjudicate any election issues. And then the other part of the theater was just the way in which lawmakers tried to use her as the platform to talk about a variety of different legislative issues, political and public issues. So, I don't know, Emily?
I mean, I think you're totally right about the effect that the Bork hearing had. And ever since then, the nominees have had a real incentive not to say anything controversial. What's amazing is, like, we have learned less and less about their actual views progressively over the hearings. So I am left in the situation of thinking about Amy Coney Barrett, of grasping at how extreme her refusal to answer the questions was, right? So, like, to me, basically, the most notable thing was that asked whether the president has the power to unilaterally delay the election, she said she couldn't answer because that would be legal punditry. This is a law. Like, it's written in the statute that the election has to proceed. There's nothing about the president having that power. I mean, you could imagine, like, if there was a nuclear bomb that hit the country. But, like, the idea that you couldn't say something that obvious. And the same thing was true about her refusal to answer a question about Trump having an obligation to peacefully transfer power if he loses the election. And so, look, you can say that she's playing it really safe and, like, sure, there's some hypothetical eventuality, or maybe not that hypothetical, where that might come before her. But it's the refusal to say that, like, the paint on the bench that I just put there is wet, or the sky is blue, that seems really striking here, in addition to the fact that she has actually all these statements about her views on the record that she also doesn't want to address, even though in a lot of ways we know more about her stance on controversial issues like guns and abortion and previous challenges to the Affordable Care Act than we've known about the last few nominees.
Can I just jump in and say this codifies an extremely frustrating cycle, which is that in order to rise through the, and you shoot me down, Emily, if this is wrong, but in order to rise through the ranks, you have to signal at various points your views on a series of very political issues. And then when you get nominated, you have to exercise what seems to me to be as an excessive political instinct rather than judicial one, to not say anything at all, to know how to avoid everything. And therefore, it creates an incentive for maximally political judicial nominees who, on the one hand, know how to show it, and on the other hand, don't know how to show it, both of which are not seem to be adjacent and not central to the job of making, or not making, but the job of adjudicating.
And then we also have to listen to these sanctimonious bromides, which, not just Amy Coney Barrett, I mean, it was true about Justice Kagan in particular among the liberals too, of like, I will interpret the law as written and, you know, the words on the page. Like, these are not determinative principles in contested Supreme Court cases. Like, yes, much of the time, judges do their jobs in a non-ideological way based on the words on the page and everybody agrees. But the Supreme Court is there for the hard cases in which the lower courts often disagreed. And the cases that the American people are the most concerned about, having to do with, you know, knotty, uncertain interpretations of what does equal protection mean in the 14th Amendment, like, there is no answer on the page. It is just not true. It is not true that it is interpreting the law as written. And I have sat through so many of these, and I'm so tired of that sanctimony.
So, Emily, what would you have us do? Because there is this, it is clear she has spent her whole career, as John indicated, signaling to people how she feels about
these. She signed a letter saying issues. That abortion was a barbaric yes. practice. Like, yes. Okay, that clearly means something to you if you use that language.
Yes, so she's spent all this time signaling. That is why she is the top choice of the Susan B. Anthony list. That is why the Federalist Society, you know, is very keen on her. It's why President Trump, who has said he would only nominate pro-life judges, is so keen on her. So we are pretty clear on it. So what would be the change that you could make to this process or to some process that would allow you to learn something from these hearings? Because, like, everyone has now learned how to game it. Like, everyone knows how to play it. And it's simply since you don't have to convince anyone. I guess if you ever have a situation where you have a president of one party and a Senate that's controlled by a majority of another party, then you'll have a situation where you have to persuade people. But otherwise, it's simply an exercise in power politics. So what can be done with this hearings that would make them valuable? Or are they just completely screwed forever?
Well, I mean, this idea that you don't have to convince anyone is actually very recent, because we had, you know, even like 70, 60 something votes for candidates like Kagan and even like Alito, I think, and John Roberts, unless I'm mistaken. So, I mean, this may not be the answer to your political question, but legally speaking, we should have much more room for nominees to answer questions about past cases. Like, it is just ridiculous that you can't say what you think about the merits of a precedent from 20 or 30 years ago or 10 years ago. Yes, they should not comment on cases that are currently in circulation that should come before them. But there is a lot more room to express views on past cases than any of them want to touch anymore. And you can see the goalposts moving. I mean, it used to be like, absolutely you would say that Brown versus Board was good law, right? Like, nobody wants to touch that one. But there were other cases, too, that we could agree on that, you know, were, like, not really up for grabs anymore. Like Connecticut versus Griswold, which is the predecessor to Roe versus Wade. This is, Griswold is a 1960s case from Connecticut about whether, it was in this case, a married woman has the right to buy birth control. Like, basically whether the state can be so interfering in the lives of married couples in particular that they could ban birth control purchases. And everyone agreed, like, there was some basic privacy right that was violated there. Now people usually don't even want to talk about Griswold. Like, there's just this refusal to kind of express any view about a past body of law. And it's bad. Like, it just doesn't educate the American public. That's why we get stuck with all this, like, baloney about originalism.
Thanks for listening to the Slate Political Gabfest. On behalf of Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you soon. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe to the podcast.